she want to be a lady?
No, it's a
I wonder why you were doing
that. I told her about my husband and I've been together. I've been a pastor for us to do when the last one goes to college. That's what we've done for 30 years.
Make sure your microphone's on. We will go around the table for identifications, starting with Mr. Diamond.
Good. Rory Diamond, District 13.
Reggie Gaffin, District 7.
Aaron Bowman, District 3.
Terrence Freeman, at large, Group 1.
Randy White, District 12.
Randy DeFore, District 14.
Danny Beckton, District 11.
Scott Wilson, District 4.
Michael Boylan, District 6.
Good morning. Tommy Azuri, Group 3, at large.
Al Ferrero, District 2.
Brenda Priestley Jackson, District 10.
Sam Newby, Group 5 at large. Garrett Dennis, District 9.
Jacoby Pittman, District 8.
Well, thank you all for being here. I appreciate everyone's attention. First of all, I do want to thank President Wilson for your appreciation. We've got a bad one. You got it?
Yeah.
You're good. And importance of the work that we are about to undertake and your expression of confidence in me in facilitating this fact-finding set of workshops. Thank you very much. And I don't know if you want to comment on
this microphone might be the problem. I would just like to thank you for your leadership on this issue and thank each one of my colleagues for being here. I'd also like to thank, I see Judge Arnold and Jason Gabriel in the room, as well as many other union leaders and residents who are very interested in this conversation. So thank you for leading this cause, and I look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. I referenced the word facilitate in that last sentence of mine, and I'm not leading this effort. I'm merely trying to guide us, all of us, through it. And when I say all of us, I mean constituents, council members, and other interested parties. Our purpose is singular: to fully prepare ourselves and the constituents we represent for whatever proposed changes and to structure and our operations that the GE Board and management may present to us in the coming months. To that end, we'll bring you these discussions with the help of subject matter experts that will be identified by the council whom we will soon be retaining, but also from the JEA Board of Management and the individuals that they had identified to help them in doing the work that they were doing. And this is going to be a journey. It's going to take us a couple of months to get through this process. We had an organizational meeting on Monday with my colleagues, and we made some changes to the schedule, and further changes to the schedule likely will be made, and I do appreciate their input in this process. Public involvement is very important to this process. In addition to doing what we're doing today, a lot of listening, we also have opportunities for you to provide your input. We're going to try and keep the schedule very tightly to 90 minutes for the discussion we have around the table here, and to provide 30 minutes for comments by folks in the audience if you choose to do so. You'll need to fill out a green card. And what we'll do, we'll apportion the time based upon the number of cards we have from the folks in the audience. However, I do want to make certain that we ask that you request that during the course of that process that your conversation or presentation should be limited to the topic we are presenting today and or suggestions or questions about future topics. We're not here to talk about what we should do at this point in time, merely to understand the process that we're going through and what we need to learn in order to make a sound decision in the future. It's my understanding that all the workshops will be available for public viewing on a number of electronic platforms, including the COJ website. You'll also be able to post comments or pose questions regarding an upcoming topic. As you can see by the agenda, today's sessions will cover essentially three items. The first is some background on the Office of General Counsel and the rationale for when and the process by which special counsel is identified. It's a process we've kind of gone through already, and most of my colleagues are familiar with it, but for the benefit of the general audience out there, we want to share this process with you as well. Frankly, the focus of the second item changed a bit. Initially, the accident, if you will, was put on the authority of the independent authorities. But thanks to the comments and questions raised by my colleagues at our organizational meeting on Monday, we changed the emphasis a bit. It's being shifted really to the authority of the City Council as it relates to the respective authorities. Just exactly what is the line of demarcation? Frankly, the ability of the Council to materially address decisions made by the Board and management of any given authority, but obviously in this case specifically JEA. No worries. Yesterday, the Jacksonville City Council provided our membership a letter from its JEA subcommittee and an opinion memo that specifically addresses the Council's authority in such matters, and a presentation by the group by the Florida Municipal Power Authority. We won't be delving into the latter two, but Ms. Jean Miller is in the room, and we'll be inviting her up a little bit later on to share a little bit about the process they've undertaken and some of the general conclusions they have reached as early on in their process. Our first presenter today is the Honorable Judge Charles Arnold Jr. Oh, thank you. I have coaches here. I'm going to need them. We have a court reporter here, and the court reporters asked that that the initial time my colleagues speak, that you identify yourself so that she will know who you are in this process. Thank you, Tom. Okay, again, our first speaker today, our presenter today, is the former retired judge, a circuit court judge, and I'm very excited to have him here. He was the Fourth Circuit Court judge in the Fourth Circuit Court in Florida from 1997 until his retirement in 2012. However, he did spend a number of years practicing law, 30 years prior to that, and spent three years, as from 92 to 94, judge, as the Office of General Counsel. So we're going to open up the floor to you and let you talk a little bit about the history of the General Counsel role and also as it relates specifically to the identification of specialized counsel.
Thank you, Councilman Dolan. Is this working now? Or?
Close enough. You have to move it closer, probably.
All right. Actually, I'm still a senior circuit judge. The only thing important about that is I have the ability to get any of you out of jail on any given day, if need be. However, depending on what you did, you may have to go back later, but don't hesitate to call me. Councilman Boland and I and Jason Gabriel thought it was it might be of interest to you to a little bit of background about the General Counsel's Office, why it got formed to start with. And since you've already decided to hire some additional attorneys, some background on that as well, what has happened in past years, and it might be able to give you some guidance. Just a little bit of my background. On October 1 of 68, I was an assistant counsel to Judge William L. Durden, who was the initial general counsel. And it was my job to represent the city in a number of the lawsuits that were filed challenging the constitutionality of the charter. And, in fact, I got to argue the case in front of the Florida Supreme Court once it was on appeal, which was a lot of fun since I graduated from law school in August of 68. So it was a great start. It was a wonderful time to be in City Hall. I could go through and name every city councilman then and tell you all about them. They were just wonderful folks. Everybody had the interest of the people in mind and just making a new government work, and it was just great fun to be there. Mayor Tansler, Judge Durden, Ted Grissett was president, Sally Mathis, John Lanahan. I could go on and on. Some fellow named Carlucci that kept half the staff of the General Counsel's Office busy with questions, which so you can sort of understand one of your fellow members and where all of that came from. Everything was a legal question back in 1968. I recall the people from Nashville who had consolidated their government came down to speak with Mayor Tansler to find out about our government. Was it a strong mayor government, council government, mayor council? What was it? And I sat in Mayor Tansler's office with Judge Durden when his answer to the Nashville folks was, it's a strong general counsel form of government is what it is. I can't do anything except what the general counsel tells me I can do. And I'm sure y'all can appreciate that because you've gotten some binding opinions that obviously help you with your job. The and then coming up to 92 and 94, I actually served as general counsel under Mayor Austin. And back in 2014, I sat on Laurie Boyer's committee who studied the charter and some changes on that. I think I'm one of two lawyers that are still alive that worked for the city in 1968. And so for that reason, I got invited because I've been here since the beginning. And just wanted to share with you a little bit about the office and conflicts or perceived conflicts, hiring outside counsel. Those questions always arise, whether it's representing the constitutional officers, the independent bodies, constitutional bodies. And the reason the office got formed, and I assume most of you have read Richard Martin's book on A Quiet Revolution, but just a few of the things that he said in there. Prior to consolidation, there were six attorneys in the city attorney's office. There were two attorneys in the county attorney's office. And then there were attorneys for the school board, the hospital board, the sheriff, the tax assessor, the tax collector, the clerk of the court, the budget commission, the civil service board, and each one of them had between one and three attorneys. And although it doesn't sound like much now, back then they spent over $500,000 a year on attorneys. And so the legislature and the study commission decided that they needed to have one group of attorneys that represented all of the city of Jacksonville. And actually, we had 15 attorneys in the general counsel's office the first year, and we saved the city $250,000 just that first year in attorney's fees alone. But the all of these attorneys, they were always suing on behalf of their clients. They were always suing each other, too. And that led to a whole lot of litigation and inconsistent opinions and So it really, the general counsel really became the judge of the government, as opposed to just a lawyer giving advice. The general counsel decided things, and y'all were stuck with it. And a great deal of thought went into that, and since then, there's been a lot of discussion as to whether that is the right approach to legal answers. And it kind of came about because of accident. If you look at Article 8, Section 9 of the Constitution, which set all this up, it gave the legislature, followed by referendum, the authority to combine everything, the tax collector, the sheriff, the property appraiser, even the school board, would be departments of the city of Jacksonville. And they'd all operate under the mayor and council. So that made it pretty easy. They were all the clients of the general counsel. Well, then in an effort to get consolidation passed, everybody got worried. If you do away with these constitutional officers or you do away with the Beaches and Baldwin, we may not win. And so they started spreading these things out and leaving them as elected constitutional officers and boards. And by doing that, though, they didn't touch the legal department. They left that alone. That still made everything they did subject to central services, general counsel, and so forth. So they didn't like that. Morgan Slaughter sued us several times. Over the years, there were several lawsuits about that. And the best way to look at the general counsel's office is when you're dealing with the primary government, that is the mayor, the council, independent authorities, is the it's like General Motors. You got Chevrolet, used to have Pontiac, you still have Buick. And that's all part of General Motors, though. And so you're all part of the same government. And you have one attorney that is representing all of you. Where it gets a little tricky is when you get to the constitutional officers and the school board. I've been bothered since day one that there may be some inherent conflicts in representing all those folks. But Jason wrote an opinion in 2016 that covered that subject, talked about the ethical ramifications. And if you hadn't read it, you should do that. And it's really a very well-written opinion and answers a lot of those questions. When is it appropriate to go get outside counsel? Obviously, if there's some third party besides the city involved, like the landfill cases when the federal government came after everybody, you had private business and the city were defendants, and the private business didn't want the city attorney representing them, so the city had to go hire outside counsel. Bond issues, the underwriters want separate bond counsel. And on occasion, the general counsel's office just simply doesn't have the expertise to properly advise their clients, and it's certainly fine to go out and get people to do that. That doesn't really apply to the independent authorities as far as having to get independent counsel unless the general counsel doesn't have the expertise to do it. There's even been thoughts over the year that, for example, I won't talk much about it because it's pending, where you have the school board suing the city. You could actually have all the private firms do it. We build something called a Chinese wall, and that is you have one group of attorneys that don't talk to another group of attorneys in the same law firm, and you could represent both sides. And I've suggested to Jason that's something they want to think about. Actually, that's the way he arrives at most of his opinions. So one of his lawyers gets one side, and one of the lawyers get another. But he's the judge, and he decides. But I think that system has worked very well over the years. And nobody, other than President Wilson, to use a today's example, nobody catches more hell in this building than the general counsel does. And that's because the general counsel's decisions are tough, and he's got a lot of clients pulling him in a lot of directions. Just to give you some example, I remember, and there was recently an article in the paper about it. I won't spend much time on it. But we had Westinghouse Tenneco come to town, and it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And they formed OPS, and they put this big old crane out on Blunt Island, and it was going to be the most wonderful thing to the economy there could be. And they were going to build these floating generating plants, and it was actually, they weren't going to build it in the river. They were going to float it off Atlantic Beach. They were going to sell them up and down the coastline. And but the contract with the city, or the JEA and the city, had a lot of liability issues for the city. And Harry Shorstein, who was general counsel and a good friend, he said, no, you just can't do that. You can't subject the city to that kind of liability. And he was vilified everywhere for ruining this great economic opportunity. But can you imagine if Dorian had parked off Atlantic Beach on top of a nuclear generating plant, where we'd be today? We'd had a nuclear reactor probably floated up to this building, and we'd be like Chernobyl, and none of us would live here anymore. So his advice seemed pretty good over the years. I recall back in 92 when I was general counsel, and we were negotiating with the Jaguars, the lease, and everybody wanted the Jaguars here, including me. But we had a problem with the cost of the stadium. It started at $75 million, and then it went to $100 million, and then it went to $120 million, and then it went to $150 million. And then the Jaguars took the position, well, whatever it costs, you got to build it, because Mr. Weaver is going to invest $200 million, and he didn't want a partially built stadium. And I said, no, we've got to have a firm price, and because the city can't enter into a contract without a firm number on the end. Well, quite understandably, they said, well, Chuck's being mean, so we're not coming to town. Well, fortunately, John Delaney and Lex Hester and some of the other folks got a hold of the negotiation after me, and it was actually Lex Hester's idea. Well, we'll give you $150 million since you're guaranteeing that's what it'll cost, and you build the damn stadium, and then that number will work. And it did, so it worked out just great. And John and Lex actually came over that deal and did a super job. But I just point out those situations to you because it is a tough job. And just because on any given day you don't like the advice of your lawyer, I can assure you he has the best interest of the people of the city of Jacksonville in mind. So with that, that kind of brings us up to today. As far as the JEA and y'all's relationship to it, I'll let Jason speak to that, and then if you have any questions about it later, I'll be glad to talk about that. But anyway, I hope that that bit of background maybe helps you a little bit of some of our past squabbles and past hiring attorneys and how the program is supposed to work anyway.
Great. So we've got about 15 minutes for questions in this section here, and I think we can kick it off with a conversation, specifically instances where you found it necessary during your tenure to hire an independent or specialized counsel and the parameters that you set around in doing that. Give us an example of that.
Well, actually, I didn't hire any. Because okay. We knew everything. No, that's, that's a joke. We didn't. And I can remember because Judge Durden taught me how I was supposed to be general counsel, I thought. And that was Durden's. We didn't hire anybody when Durden was general counsel, other than bond counsel. The only time I know of that outside counsel was hired on a pure what we call conflict of interest was back in 87 when Judge Harrison was general counsel. And the police and fire pension fund, which y'all have all had a lot of discussion about and litigation with over the years, he just flat wrote an opinion that it was a conflict of interest for his office to represent the city, the council, the mayor, and the police and fire pension fund, and they could go hire their own lawyer, and they did. And while I was general counsel, we got in a dispute with Sheriff McMillan about getting his retirement and his pay, and I recall asking one of my attorneys, Laurie French, I said, how in the world does the police and fire have their own lawyer? They're part of the government. She went and found this opinion for me, which didn't think much of at the time, but I thought a lot of Judge Harrison. I know he honestly felt that he should do that. And then, as I said, the 2016 opinion of Jason Gabriel kind of talks about that, really corrects what I think was a mistake back then, even though it was his best interest. But really, it's the situations I talked about earlier when you go hire independent counsel. Really, and it really comes down to when you need the expertise of somebody that isn't in the office. For example, and I thought, in fact, Harry used some other folks. They didn't charge him, but dealing with nuclear energy, that's a pretty heavy subject. You don't have lawyers that do that every day. But anyway, so much for that.
I'm going to refer to the memo, Jason, that you produced back on September the 23rd. Is there anything specific in there that you want to speak to as it relates to the topic of a selection of specialized counsel?
Jason Gabriel, General Counsel. No, not really. I mean, if there's a question, obviously, I'm happy to entertain it. I think it's pretty straightforward, and it's the process that we're actually undertaking now, you know, as we lead up to selecting that legislative counsel that will help. And as I've said before, I mean, the one thing I'll say is this is intended to be special legalized or special legal counsel for the council as you undertake this sort of oversight capacity of this JEA project that's moving forward at this time. But ultimately, you know, it's got to be a collaborative, cooperative effort. It can't be an adversarial type proceeding. We certainly have a lot of room for debate and discussion and interpretation, but ultimately the opinions of the Office of General Counsel are the ones that prevail in any dispute. But I only say that for the benefit of the city. And I'm going to get into some of those concepts when I get into my slides that kind of underscore that proposition. But that's all I have to say at this time.
For the benefit of who may not know the story, I'll come to you in a second. Could you sort of update us as to where we are in the selection process and what that process is?
Sure. I think from the discussions that we had a few weeks ago, President Wilson kind of put in motion, I think everyone here is clear on what that is. He put in motion he selected himself, obviously, me and Carla Miller, the ethics director, as sort of this three-group administrative, staff that's going to review all of the incoming proposals. He set a deadline, I think it was October 25th, for any firms out there. I think a lot of people did some outreach and kind of canvassed, the local community and even some out-of-state, folks and players. And in any event, Council President set October 25th as a deadline to get those proposals. Cheryl Brown did a nice job of collecting them and organizing them and in distributing them to the three folks, him, me, and Carla. And we have those. We're in possession of those. We've been reviewing them. Scott's been out of town, but my understanding is we're going to be meeting today to discuss our reviews of those things and to give some advice to the council president to then take hopefully a selected set of council to the city council overall for your approval.
If I might ask, are you timeline for that is set yet, or have you determined it in terms of bringing it back to the
So our first meeting was today, and we're going to discuss the applicants that we received. And we'll see how that conversation goes. It may be worthwhile to interview some of the candidates one-on-one if we have further questions. My plan is if we can identify a firm or a set of firms to introduce that at the next council meeting. I'd like to introduce it as an emergency in and out, if that's possible. If we do that, we will submit that legislation or that firm to each member ahead of that meeting, so you have time to think about it, prepare, and discuss. The reason for the in-and-out emergency is to get someone on board to assist us as soon as possible. And like Mr. Gabriel said, whoever we hire or retain will work in collaboration with the Office of General Counsel and the attorneys that JEA has hired in hopes of not recreating the wheel, but assisting us and helping us identify and understand some of the complex questions that may arise.
Tommy?
I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't know if there's questions that had already been submitted. I don't want to circumvent that. Just to Judge Arnold, you said y'all didn't hire, but did y'all carry on? I know we had to hire an environmental attorney when we were doing landfills, and we didn't have technically a law firm like we have today, that they do have specialties. Did y'all not carry forth with the environmental? I think Frank Friedman at the time, I didn't know if he stayed on board when we were looking for the Southeast landfill or not. And then secondly, was it the 2014 legislation that allows us, or can we do it without that legislation that I think Bill Gulliford offered and we just didn't implement, was to allow the city council to hire a outside attorney? Two questions.
Okay, well, on the first one, we had an attorney on staff named McGuire.
Right.
Who had some environmental.
We had him, too.
He left and went to Rogers Towers later, and I think the city did, in fact, retain him to help after that. When we got into the landfill litigation, I had left and gone to Holland and Knight, and we actually got hired to represent not only the city but all the other 100 businesses that were involved in putting things in the landfill. So that's an example.
And we still allow, this is a question for him, but we still allow others in that need specialized attorneys like JPA for the suit that's going on right now with the dredging. And so y'all worked with them to hire or pick the firm. I don't know who picked them. So it's not without precedent that we've always had outside attorneys when we couldn't provide that kind of service, whether it was to the authorities or for our own edification. So, and so back to that other question, and I'm done. Thank you. Our ability to hire.
Yes, and so there's two rules that apply to your question. One is the charter. You've always had, I can look and confirm as to how long it's been in there. It's been certainly decades, but you've always had in the charter itself the ability to hire legislative counsel. Like I'm talking about for city council. So the charter has been consistent at least since the 80s, as far as I can tell. I think there was an amendment in 1985 where the general counsel is the chief legal advisor. So, you know, he or she is able to bind all the agencies or, you know, of the consolidated city with binding opinions. However, there's always been this sort of outlet for legislative counsel for city council. That's always been in the charter. I think what you're referring to in 2014, it was either 2013 or 2014, and I think 14. It was led by Council President Gulliford at the time, is in line with that charter provision. There was a creation of Chapter 14 in the ordinance code. And that's the one I think you're referring to, and we've talked about a couple of times. It was kind of a setup for legislative council if this city council ever wanted that. And again, we're talking about a couple different things here. There's legislative council, which is consistent council akin to Peggy and Page that gives you consistent legislative help with legislative priorities that you guys have coming before you, drafting legislation and opining in that terrain. Then there's also, you know, specialized legal counsel, and we're talking about kind of a hybrid in this case, and that's the one where you're picking someone up for some specialized.
Has a counsel ever done that before now?
On the special legal, yes. So on the legislative counsel, I understand that in the 80s, the council did do it for a couple of years. I'm talking about just pure legislative counsel that was hired by city council, but there was, and I can get you the piece of legislation. There was a piece of legislation that ended that program, I think, after a couple of years because it just wasn't working out, and they thought that the intent, there's some language in the whereases that the intent of the general counsel's office really services this. There's too much redundancy, so they went back to the model that we're still operating under today. Your question about specialized counsel
for
city council, the only one that I'm aware of, and I think this is the last time it happened, was in 2013 or 14, probably 13, a firm was engaged on a limited basis. I can pull the legislation for you. It was a pension-related question or a series of questions, and it was limited to that. And so, yes, that's an example. I'm not aware of any others, at least not recently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to try and keep us on time and on task here, but we'll entertain one more question. Ms. Jackson.
Thank you, Councilmember Boylan. Your Honor, I appreciate you taking the time, and General Counsel Gabriel, I don't envy your position at all. But I do have a couple concerns as we relate to understanding that the General Counsel is the final arbiter of all disputes between different branches of city government. And my first would be a comment. I would contend that the size of the city and the government in 1968 looks radically different in level of complexity and membership in 2019. But more specifically for me, there should be some mechanism that if an independent agency, when engaging with the city in any manner, has requested outside counsel and counsel has granted that, it almost would appear to be a trigger that the city council's involvement would necessitate outside counsel as well. Does that make sense? And that, I think, was the challenge for us in this situation. JEA, the independent authority in question, got outside counsel starting in June. And we were able to finally get outside counsel in September. And so my question is there any language in the charter, or should there perhaps be an amendment that there is something looked at or some type of triggering mechanism is if any independent agency or another branch of government needs outside counsel, and you've said they're entitled to have it, that city council is put on notice or then creates an opportunity at that point for them to get outside counsel as well.
If an independent authority hires outside counsel to help them with something, it doesn't automatically create an adversary situation. They still have to give them honest legal advice of the way it is. That advice should be shared with the council fully. Everything they tell that independent authority should be. So you shouldn't have an adversary situation. The general counsel should be able to take care of every question, legal question or otherwise, dealing with that situation. So my answer is, no, you don't need to go hire another attorney. You can rely on the general counsel's office unless they don't have the expertise.
And that's actually this scenario. So it really wasn't. I'm not looking at it as adversarial, and I know that our general counsel has been put in a different position in terms of folks not agreeing with necessarily whatever opinion you've given based on your legal research. So that's created adversity for some. That's not my position. Mine is, in the case with JEA in this nuanced situation, they got outside counsel because of different areas of expertise
right. That
they said they needed. General counsel granted that because there would be the presumption that the 40, how many members in your office? 43 members of the general counsel staff lacked that expertise. So I would say if they lacked the expertise for JEA, then the companion to that is you lack the expertise for the city council. Is there a mechanism, or would it be appropriate for any amendment to the charter or legislation to say in those scenarios, I'm not talking about forum shopping for different attorneys to advocate a different position. That's not what I'm saying. But you made a finding that your office did not have the expertise for JEA. Consequently, they were able to retain 7 different law firms. So to me, that would just almost be by default an indicator that the city council needs outside counsel because you found it in the scenario for that entity, and it's just JEA today that we didn't have it. Would it be appropriate via legislation or a charter amendment to say at that point of a trigger, I'm not talking about bond counsel, I'm not talking about some other nuanced environmental issues, something like that, but would it not be appropriate if in that scenario when you have deemed it necessary for outside counsel because the Office of General Counsel lacks the expertise, should it not be some triggering mechanism for city council at that point that we need to look at it or the city council needs? And that's just the honest question.
Mr. Gabriel, before you respond to the question to keep us on time and task, I'd like to put this in the parking lot, that question, and give you a chance to address it at a subsequent meeting, because I'm sure you're going to want to give some thought to your response to that question, because I think it's a quite valid question to the extent what should the reaction or consequence of an independent authority reaching out for additional counsel beyond what we have, because it does certainly prompt that thought.
Well, since I'm going to be through in a minute.
All right.
Let me
in
give
a minute.
A very brief answer. JEA is an independent authority. In my opinion, they're still subservient to y'all. Okay, y'all and the...
My opinion, too.
Okay. You know, it used to be the city electric department. It was a whole lot easier then. You just told them what to do. Now they got their own people that tell y'all what to do. But any of it, those lawyers over there that they hired, Every one of those people should be representing the city council as well. Everything they tell the JEA, they should tell you. Every opinion they have, you should call them in front of the city council and ask them, how come this is your opinion? And if they already got eight expertise people and you like the answers they're giving you, fine. Otherwise, you have your own backup set of attorneys that can answer things too. Plus, you can have Mr. Gabriel come in and cross-examine these other lawyers if you want to. So, I still see it as one government. That's my point. And they all work for you.
Well, that's a perfect segue to our next conversation here. Quite honestly, Judge, and I appreciate that's exactly what we're going to be doing with this scenario. We are going to be inviting the JE folks, the council people who are advising them in this process, to come and share with us their thinking for what they advised to the JEA at the point in time we need to do that. But I do want to move on to the next point of our presentation, which really is focusing on the authority of the council, that line of demarcation I talked about before. And we're going to give you 15 minutes, Jason, to make a presentation, and then we'll open up the floor to questions for the group.
Thank you, Councilmember Boylan. And I just want to say for the record, I completely agree with what the judge just said and Councilmember Brenda Friesen Jackson.
It's always good to agree with you.
Yeah, I got to say that for the record. I'm agreeing with the judge.
Allow me to recognize for the record, too, that Mr. Salem and Mr. Carlucci have since joined the group, and I appreciate your taking the time. And former Mayor John Delaney is in the back of the room, but I can't recognize him.
There he is.
All right, John, there he is. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it, Mr.
Thank
Gabriel.
You. So I kind of tailored this presentation. I've got some slides up, mostly not going to be too many pictorials. There's going to be a lot of words on the slides, but I think it's going to help with sort of articulating the points I want to make here today. And I've tailored this, with consolidation, the charter, the city at large, we can get into all sorts of esoteric discussions, but I know Mr. Boylan wants us to be short, sweet, and succinct, and to the point. So that's what we're going to do. So I've tailored this in a way so that we are talking about, just to provide a quick, brief framework, I'm going to talk about this, the city and the independent agencies, and identify all the independent agencies under the charter. But, of course, I'm going to bring it to the JEA in particular because that's the kind of the concentration of this whole workshop and this program going forward. I want to start off, though, with, and this is a great segue from the discussion we just had, that all roads lead to city council, particularly. So when we overview the agencies and their interplay with the city, particularly with respect to JEA, and I'm going to get into the the sort of spectrum of independence that there is with the agencies, but with respect to JEA in particular, all roads lead to city council. No matter how this potential JEA privatization goes, no matter what direction it takes, and we're going to go into hypotheticals as to what directions it could have taken, they all lead to city council. No way around it. So just as a preface to this discussion, I want to just outline real quick the applicable laws. And I want to start from the top and go down. In addition to federal law, of course, and state law and statute, you know, the statutes of Florida, the city of Jacksonville is guided by really two major sources of law, the charter and the ordinance code. The charter contains the general organic principles by which the city must function, including the city's foundation and general legal framework. The ordinance code, on the other hand, contains the official laws of the city, which provide the enabling mechanisms to carry out the general principles stated in the charter. So you can think of the charter as kind of like the local constitution for Jacksonville. And you can think of the ordinance code as sort of the local statutes that carry out those concepts. The cities, and this is the most important point in all of this, because it underscores everything else we're going to talk about. Because people scratch their head when they look at Jacksonville. It's truly unique. It's truly the only true, pure form of consolidation. The Constitution contemplates a few different forms, Miami-Dade being another. But even Miami-Dade has its own county commission and separate city commission. And even Miami-Dade, by the way, when you transpose, I'm going to get to the Jacksonville Consolidation Amendment in a second, which is in the Florida Constitution, but when you transpose the Miami-Dade part of the Constitution with the Duval County one, they're very similar in a lot of different ways. But Miami-Dade retained this sort of two-layer county-city type government. And, by the way, they carved out the school board in Miami-Dade, unlike in Jacksonville. deliberately carved out the school board in Miami-Dade. They have their own separate school board, but Jacksonville did not do that. And that's an important point in other venues. So the Florida Constitution. A lot of people and a lot of lawyers in Jacksonville are very aware of all the articles and sections which pertain to the school board, the county officers, sheriff, tax collector, property appraiser, all those folks, and even other sorts of special districts. I submit that until you work on a city project or until you work in the city itself, you really don't come across what is called the Jacksonville Consolidation Amendment. But that exists. It's out there. And really, again, unless you're doing something that's city-related or in the bowels of the city, you're really not going to come across this thing that much. But it's there. And it has the force of law from the highest levels of the state. So just as a preface to this, the state of Florida is governed by the Florida Constitution of 1968, as amended. That's the constitution that everyone refers to in common legal parlance in Florida. And generally, local government units, as you know, are broken down into two types of units in Florida. You got counties and municipalities. In every county but Duval, the Florida Constitution creates a county government. Every county has at least one city government, whereby the county and the city or cities can exercise separate governmental powers. The city of Jacksonville charter established the consolidated form of government, which I've referred to, and that's in the 1967 legislatively approved constitution. That basically what the legislature did is it established a charter based upon specific authority in the constitution. And let me summarize it, because there's three different years, and you keep hearing different years with respect to the Jacksonville Consolidation of Government, or Jacksonville Consolidation Government Amendment. And maybe I tried to simplify it as much as I could, and here's the best way I think I can say it. The Jacksonville-specific Consolidation Amendment in the Florida Constitution was put in place by voter-approved amendment in 1934. But in 1934, there was the 1885 Constitution. So in 1934, there was an amendment to the 1885 Constitution that created this ability for Jacksonville to completely consolidate. It's been in the books since 1934 and was exercised in 1967, and ever since 1968 has been in play. So, you know, if there's any questions about that, we can go over that again, but that's the case there. I don't expect anyone here to be able to read all the words on that slide, but I just put it there because a few council members were like, give me the specific code provision. Give me the specific constitutional provision. Well, there it is on the screen.
Can I ask? Yeah. Does anybody have a copy of this? Because we don't.
No, I asked them to create four copies for us because we had our back to the screen.
And if you'd like, I can have copies.
Okay.
And we'll be published on the website as well.
Yeah.
Randy, you still can't read it.
Okay.
Well, I can print out the charter itself.
Well, she can read it.
No. Well, the point of this is, again, it's everything that I just described, but this is what's before you, the words on that screen slide there. That is the Jacksonville Consolidation Amendment, where it basically abolished, altered, transferred all of the commissions, boards, bodies, and officers in existence at the time and incorporated them under one unitary municipal corporation called the City of Jacksonville. And that's an important thing to keep in mind as we talk about the interplay of the independent agencies and all these other things. One unitary municipal corporation called the City of Jacksonville. So, just as a quick sort of primer on the charter itself, because that sort of lends itself to the foundation of the more specific conversation, I just want to state, you know, the charter itself, again, sort of the Constitution, creates and establishes these sort of broad stroke concepts that frame the government of the City of Jacksonville. What you have in there are, and again, this is a legislatively approved, as sanctioned by the Constitution, charter. It includes provisions related to the independent agencies, which we're going to touch on in a minute. It includes provisions related to what are commonly known in the other 66 counties as constitutional officers. They are constitutional officers in Jacksonville, but the species sometimes becomes a main source of the vernacular employed when we talk about these things, because in as much as the sheriff, supervisor of elections, property appraiser, tax collector, and clerk of the courts are constitutional officers, they're also municipal officers in Jacksonville, unlike the other 66 counties. They're municipal officers in Jacksonville. And in addition to that, the charter, as we know, contains these very strong, traditional, federal-type separation of powers. We have a strong executive branch of government, and we do have a strong, I think, legislative branch of government as well. So it retains those provisions. What is an independent agency? The charter itself doesn't have a definition, but it has a provision, and I don't think I have the slide on this, but I'll if you want to write it down, it's in 18.07 of the charter. In fact, it's 18.07D, and it defines, and I'll get into that in a minute, it actually defines who the independent agencies are, and it's not exhaustive, and I'll touch on that too, but it's in there. But while these independent agencies, as I'm going to touch on, have varying degrees of independence according to their constitutionally sanctioned and legislatively approved charter articles, they all bear some similar hallmarks. And so that's what I have up on the screen. And so this is kind of a summary of what those hallmarks are. So, for example, each are considered bodies politic and corporate with the ability to sue and be sued. Each have their own executive and policymaking powers with respect to, you know, employment, operational powers and duties and things of that sort. But an important point, even with that independence, is that each has a relationship with the city, to some varying degree. Each one has a relationship with the city. Some are required to use all central services, including our office. Some are required to use procurement, some aren't. You know, these are all set forth depending on the agency. So, you know, notwithstanding the independence, there's a certain level of tethering. And again, it's different for each agency.
If I may interject very quickly, we'll make sure it gets on the website, but there was a two-page summary that Mr. Clemens had created that spoke to each of the agencies or authorities.
Yes.
and their relationship to other entities outside of City of Jacksonville.
Yes, and it was a good one. I have one maybe clarification to it, but it was a good summary, so hopefully everybody has that. And so just to touch on the identified independent agencies in the charter, let's start with the Duval County School Board. It's in Article 13 of our city charter. That one is a little different from the other ones in the sense that that's the only one, it's considered an independent agency. I mentioned 18.07 in the charter defined. It defines independent agencies. School board is one of them. But I will tell you that that is the only one that has its own elected body. When we get through all the other ones, they're all appointed. But that's the only one with an elected body of seven members from, you know, as everybody knows, they come from nonpartisan elected districts, seven districts, which are comprised of, I think, every two of the 14 council districts, as we all know. So, you know, that's how they're set up, and they have some they have quite a bit of independence, obviously, by their very nature and their function. There are some tetherings in the charter, and we can talk about that later if you'd like. But anyway, I just wanted to note that. The Police and Fire Pension Fund is the Board of Trustees. That one consists of five members, two City of Jacksonville residents appointed by the City Council, one police officer elected by the majority of the police officer members of the pension, and then a firefighter elected in the same manner, and then a fifth member chosen by a majority of the other four who's confirmed by council. You have a JAA board that consists of seven members, three appointed by the mayor and confirmed by council, four appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. JPA is sort of the opposite, same, but the opposite in terms of the who picks who. JPA board consists of seven members, four appointed by the mayor and confirmed by the council, three appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And then you have a JHA board. That one comes by virtue of Florida statute in Chapter 421. That one consists of seven members, all appointed by the mayor, confirmed by the council. The JTA, our transportation authority, that one is unique in the sense that it's well-established in the Florida statutes. There's actually a whole chapter, 349, that's dedicated purely to Jacksonville Transportation Authority. And that one sets up a board that consists of seven members, three appointed by the mayor, confirmed by council, three appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and then the last person is the district secretary for DOT, serving Jacksonville. And then, last but not least, JEA board. That one consists of seven members appointed by the mayor and confirmed by this city council. So I think it's important that you have that sort of framework so you can just see sort of the variety and groupings of the agencies that are involved. And so now at this point, I'd like to quickly turn over to the articles that are pertinent to JEA. Am I doing okay on time, council member?
We've got a couple. We'll give you a couple extra minutes.
Oh, okay. All right. And I'm almost done. But I think these were important because I think I saw several questions that came up. And I think if you – they're all kind of similar in a way. And, of course, we'll entertain the questions here as we speak. But the three provisions I'm going to bring up here, or two, are very pertinent to those questions. So there have been some questions asked whether JEA can do what it's doing in terms of this privatization option that it's currently looking at and undertaking. And the answer to that is yes. And by the way, that's not the only way that it can be pursued. There's a variety of ways. One initiated by the mayor, one initiated by the JEA in a different format that doesn't require procurement. Or potentially, I haven't studied it yet, a city council member could probably put something in the hopper. I haven't reviewed that yet, but that may be yet another. So it's important. With this theme of all roads lead to city council, the opening section of a potential JEA sale has some potential different ways of how that can.
A city council member could introduce something.
Yeah, through the chair to Councilmember Carlucci. What I mean by that is, my only point in that is that there are potentially a variety of ways that a privatization review could be initiated. I'm mentioning for the record, I haven't studied that, but as I'm thinking it through, certainly JEA has the ability to do it. The city, the mayor has the ability to do it. Regardless, it has to come to city council. But what I am mentioning is that perhaps a city council member could also do that too. I only mentioned that as
I'll stop at that.
Thank you.
Wait till questions
I appreciate
and answers.
It. Thank
but
you.
I have a question that when we
Please.
Get there.
So it's important to point out the power. Where does that come from? That power. Well, it's in Article 21. It's in Section 21.04p. And by the way, this is just a subsection of that overall section. And this was recently approved by your predecessor, city council. And I'll get into what exactly it was, but initiated by Councilmember Cressman, there was a straw ballot that spoke to this. So this was a studied provision. And what it says is basically that JEA can transfer any function or operation which comprises more than 10% of the total of the utility systems by sale, lease, or otherwise to any other utility, public or private, without approval of the council. Provided, however, no approval by the council shall become effective without subsequent referendum approval in the terms and conditions of the sale. I'm sorry, but the way I read it might have sounded a little off. They can't sell more than 10% without the approval of council. I hope everyone caught that.
No
so
referendum.
So the flip side of that is they could sell less than 10%, and there's got to be some initiating factor into what they're selling.
And I think there's some consideration about they can't piecemeal it. Sell 10, 9
That's
today,
correct.
And 9 tomorrow, and 9 today.
That was a previous council member had asked that very question. So anyway, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that further when there's questions. I want to move on real quick to another section, 21.05, which is the only point of this is that the JEA has been given broad plenary powers within the space of utilities. So JEA is empowered under the charter with these liberally construed powers to carry out their utility-based operations and duties, 21.05 of the charter. I just want to mention, it's not on the slides, I'll mention another provision. 21.09 of the charter states that JEA is not subject to Chapter 126 of the city's ordinance code, which is the procurement code. It is applicable if JEA doesn't have its own procurement rules. However, JEA does have its own procurement rules, so that's an important point. Real quick, we've gone over this, I think, over the summer, the ways to amend the charter. There's a few different ways that can be done. I mention that because there are some specified areas that can only be done by referendum. City Council has a lot of home rule power on a whole set of other areas. But that's important because that's a backdrop for a specified provision in the charter unique to JEA that is unlike any other provision anywhere in the charter where, with a few very limited restrictions, city council, what those a bunch of words on there say is basically city council can amend really any portion of the article of JEA, anything in Article 21 with some limited exception, with a two-thirds vote. That's, and so that point right there, while there's varying degrees of independence with all these various agencies, the point of that and what that provision underscores is that the JEA is the closest to the city in terms of its dependence and capacity for the city council to affect change, an amendment to the JEA, the control, JEA's destiny, and those sorts of things. So I kind of rushed through this, and I'll wrap up, and I'll basically say, like, as I said at the outset of this whole presentation, all roads lead to city council, and you have ultimate legislative authority to do a lot, if not everything, in this case. And we can talk about, you know, those.
Thank you, Jason. Before we entertain questions, let me just comment for the benefit of the audience here that we advised and provided the opportunity for city council members at our meeting on Monday to provide questions in advance. You know, there was hope that they would be involved and incorporated in the presentations that are being made today, but not all of them did. Those questions also will be posted online for others to see as well. And in future topics, we are providing information to well in advance the city council members so they can generate their questions, and those, too, will be put on in advance, as well as the comments or questions raised by individuals who utilize the website in providing us with some comments on it. With that, we'll ask Mr. Ferraro.
Thank you. So, Mr. Gabriel, if I heard you correctly in part of that, so if I, as a city council member, wanted to put forth a bill to put the electric authority back under city council, that would be something I could put through and have it as a JEA department, and you could have the electric department, the sewer department, and the water department. What would that end up doing with JEA? Would that be getting rid of board members? How would that be, or what you're talking about?
So through the chair to Councilmember Ferraro, the quick answer to your question is yes, the city council could do that. It could dissolve JEA and bring it back under the bosom of the city and make it a city department, a utility department. It could do that. You have the two-thirds vote. You'd have to amend the charter. We'd have to look at some other things, but that would be just a direct answer to your question.
I know we're talking just about JEA, but would that be with all the authorities, just as a quick answer?
Actually, the answer to that is I believe no, because, for example, the port and the aviation authority were split in 2001 legislatively. It used to be under one title, and those are legislatively approved. I'd have to research that, but something tells me that I think some state legislature approval may be required in that case. Again, underscoring the point that JEA is much more under the dependence, or they're dependent on the city.
Okay.
Mr. Carlos, you had a follow-up.
Randy was before me, but I'll go. I'll wait my turn.
All right.
Thank you.
Ms. DeFore.
Get your person.
Councilwoman DeFore.
I'm going to make a statement, and then I'm going to ask a question, because my question I don't think was answered. So I'm going to re-ask my question. But as a statement, thank you, Judge Arnold, for being here. Because one of the things that we find ourselves in and why we're here today is that we have been kept completely in the dark. So when these outside counsel were hired for the JEA and their memorandums of legal opinions were given, we to this day have not received those legal opinions. So we don't know what was asked of them. We don't know, you know, we have no idea. So I'm going to ask that we be provided with those legal opinions so that can help us clarify where we are today. Secondly, I have reviewed the charter, and specifically 21, and I did not see anywhere in there where the JEA has authority to seek to sell themselves. I didn't see everything that I read talked about keeping itself in existence. So if you could show me where that is.
It's section 21.04P of the charter.
I read that, but that referenced further existence of the JEA. It did not represent selling itself.
I read it differently than you.
Okay, well, yeah. Let's read it together. Nothing in this article shall authorize or be construed to authorize JEA to transfer any function or operation which comprises more than 10% without the approval of City Council. What did I miss?
Right. So how does it
So how are they able to do this today without our approval?
JEA today, if this ITN wasn't in play, they chose to choose a procurement process as a channel to bring it to City Council.
Okay, that leads me to my second question. A procurement process, a legal... It's in my stuff.
If you let her finish, let's finish responding.
I want to propose that what JEA could have done is they could have reached out to one vendor or one bidder, come up with a package, a sales transaction, packaged it up, and brought it to City Council without a procurement process.
Okay, well, that led me to my second question, which you were provided before we were here today. A procurement process is the acquisition of goods and services. I have never seen a procurement process used to sell oneself. Can you tell me how that's possible legally?
It's possible legally. I mean, I don't know how to help you with that basic understanding of the law. It can certainly use the procurement process to sell itself. I guess one could argue that that's a more objective and more above board way of trying to objectively look at what may be out there, as opposed to going directly to any vendor and packaging a deal and bringing it. I mean, there's a variety of ways that this could be taken up and brought to City Council. But let's not lose sight of the fact that City Council is the one with the ultimate legislative approval to approve or deny this whole thing. They have the right to do that. They're an independent authority. If you want to change the controls and the authority of JEA, do so with the power I've just told you about, with a 2/3 vote, change the JEA's charter and do it. It was done recently under Councilmember Crescenbeny and his charter amendment to add that the voters have to actually approve any sale. That wasn't in there before. It ended with City Council. But now the voters get to approve it. So this was studied. This was discussed. It's been debated.
Where's it been studied? Can you provide that to us?
It's on the website. There's about 2 years' worth of literature and resources that from your predecessors and so forth. Absolutely. I'll send it to you.
And if I may interject, too, we are going to obviously reach out to the council of JEA through this process. We will have a chance to speak to them directly with respect to their opinions and recommendations they have made to JEA during the course of this process, but just not today.
Councilmember Boylan, if I may just say, any memos that counsel to JEA have provided, you're entitled to. If that's what you want, we'll get those packaged and get it over to you. Because as the judge said earlier, he's absolutely right, and some of this has been discussed. I think I've proposed it before. You're entitled to all the information that JEA has in terms of all this stuff.
Correct. Mr. Carlucci, you had another follow-up question.
Yes. Observation. I believe in the authority system. I believe in it. It's there for a reason. Somewhat dovetailing on what Councilmember DeFore was saying, is there a way? There's always a way. John Lanahan said with 10 votes you can get anything you want in Jacksonville. I think it takes 13 now, but it used to be 10. Can a council member introduce legislation, an ordinance, to just pull the plug on this whole thing, because it's so off track and the trust level is so low that sometimes you just have to pull the plug? That was done in the previous administration when there was a pension bill going through, and that's kind of where we're at. So can the council, if somehow 10 votes were to be gathered or 13, pull the plug on this whole process and take a breather, because it is incorporating so much of our time, and then we're going to have Lot J coming down the pike. We're going to have so many other city business issues coming up, and this is absorbing so much of our time of something that really the people don't want. So can a council member introduce an ordinance to unplug this whole thing at whatever time that might be?
Through the chair to Councilmember Carlucci. I'm not going to speak to trust levels and what information.
No, I'm just giving my observations from my constituents.
Understood. To answer your question, the answer is no, not during the pendency of a procurement process, a valid procurement process. Now, ultimately, if it makes its way to you, you can vote it down. I want to also say, and this is in relation to, I think, some conversations I've had with Councilmember Priestley Jackson, is you're also not, as long as, again, we're not talking about the integrity or the specifics in a way that, that involve bidders or things like that on the ongoing procurement process as being undertaken, there is the ability for you to change the charter of JEA today, again, as long as we're adhering to these rules we've talked about, to change those powers and functions in a way so that in the future, if there were ever a discussion of potentially selling JEA, they get your permission first. Or that only the city council would be involved with that process. You could change the charter to do that, but there is an ongoing procurement process right now. There's something called the cardinal rule in procurement that we have to adhere to, which is you can't mess up the ongoing integrity of a process. Now, to answer your question, I think one of the things you could do, JEA is right down the street. Y'all can are more than welcome within the confines of Sunshine to be talking to JEA management and others to talk about what you just said. And if that's really an issue, convince JEA to pull the plug if that's such a hardcore principle for you, then you're welcome to do so. Well,
Councilmember Carlucci, I certainly appreciate your comment, but I'm hopeful that as a group that we take this journey together and keep an open mind in this process. I think we have to be informed and engaged.
I want
to
know what
and
all our options
I can't be,
are.
I don't know that we want to be specifically reactive to what all of us need. We've got a lot of learning to do in this process, and
Mr.
I'm hopeful
Chairman,
that
I just want to know what our options are as a
and
council.
I think we understand the options are that we have an opportunity at this day to change the charter.
I am not interested in changing the charter unless it's needed to be. I believe in our charter. I just think we've gone astray on this issue.
Well, so I understand from your response then the charter right now to stop a procurement process, the only way we could do that is by making a change to the charter.
You could change fundamental operational parts of the charter and make it so that only city council could initiate
Council it. Councilmember Dennis was next in the queue.
Thank you, Councilman Bolton, and through the chair. Judge Arnold, thank you for being here. I have one question specifically for you, and then the other two quick questions for General Counsel Gabriel. How do you feel about individuals speaking to this body under oath? And what's your view on that?
Well, as I recall, the charter does have a provision authorizing you to administer oaths to folks. My personal opinion is you ought to reserve that and use it only very carefully to people who you think may be coming here and lying to you. If they're just folks that are coming here to provide you information, you don't need to administer an oath.
Do you think that this rises to the occasion to administer oath? I mean, this is something huge, and I know I received something last night in the mail an email from the Civic Council where they've been slow to get information from JEA, and I know I've been slow to get information, and it just not to talk about the trust factor, but do you think this major transaction with the entire city watching on what we do, does this rise to the level of anyone that comes before us taking oath? And all due respect, when someone comes to your courtroom, regardless of if they're, are they under oath?
Well, that's everybody is when you go to court. That would be a decision for the majority of the council to decide. If you want to place everybody under oath, that's certainly up to y'all to do, and you certainly can do it. Whether you should or not, I think it's y'all's decision. I just hate what they do in Washington, so it bothers me.
Yeah, I totally understand that. My next question, I was always under the impression that only 19 people in the city of Jacksonville can file legislation, not the executive branch, not independent authority. Is that true? Can JEA file legislation? Can the school board file legislation? I thought only 19 people in the city can file legislation.
Through the chair to Councilmember Dennis. So it would have to be introduced by a council member. So, just like a bunch of different legislation that the mayor's office does from time to time. The mayor's office could conceivably package something and introduce it through the council president, and then it would be before you. That's how that would work. And then on the JA side, they have a board. They can pass a resolution, whatever the proposition, and they can request that the council president introduce it, or I suppose a council member. But yes, I mean, your council is in charge of your legislation. That's correct.
So even when the mayor files legislation, the mayor cannot file legislation. He has to have a sponsor, whether it's the council president or one of the other 18 members. So the mayor alone cannot file legislation.
There is, to answer your question, yes, there is the requirement that it be introduced, and there's some code provisions that speak to introducing by the council president and it not being.
So to one of my colleagues said that that it has to be a question. JEA cannot file legislation. So JEA can put a package together, bring it over to council, but if none of the 19 introduces it, it's dead on arrival. Am I correct?
You are correct, except that the council, there's a provision in the charter, in the ordinance code that speaks to if there's a resolution, there's a ministerial operational duty on the council president that when any of the collegial bodies pass something, it's introduced, and it even goes on to say, just because council president is introducing doesn't mean he's endorsing it or she's endorsing it, but there is that in there.
So the council president is required to file legislation that is brought to?
I believe so, yeah, under the ordinance.
Shall or may?
All right, can we move on? Did you get your answer?
Yeah, and my last question. Through the procurement process, is there a clause in the procurement process at any point the city of Jacksonville can pull a bid or RFP or IT and all, off the street, even in the middle of the process?
I don't have it before me. It's been a while since I've looked at it, but I believe, and then we're talking about city-specified procurements.
Government procurement.
I think there is an ability for the city to pull the plug. I think they can reject all, but you got to be obviously fair play on all of it. You got to do it across the board.
I think there is a
requirement to that degree.
Well, we'll identify that and make sure information comes to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hazzuri.
Thank you. Just a quick. Just for clarification, earlier you said, and I think Chuck may have said it, that we can put our ears to whatever the JEA attorneys are really working with us too, our workforce, or however you wanted to describe it. But how do we do it in sync without waiting to read the minutes or reading whatever? How do our attorney, maybe our outside attorney, or y'all? How do we find out what they're saying at the same time that they're saying it?
So, let's be careful.
I just think it's important. Well, yeah.
No, you said a while ago.
I mean, that's important. I think Councilman Bowman mentioned something alluding to that earlier, and you mentioned it right now.
And Councilmember Priestley Jackson brought it up earlier on, and it's a good point.
Tell us how that works.
I think you got to be careful what you wish for because
I don't wish for it. I just know how we do it.
I'm just saying, by automation, if you want just everything, you're going to get inundated with a bunch of different stuff, I would suspect. What I would recommend, but I'm open to your input on this. What I'd recommend is that it's on a case by case basis. I understand there's a little bit of how does council know that something's happening, when Jake is the one leading the charge? Well, I mean, maybe we can think of a way, and we can come back to this, but thinking of a way, like on a case by case basis, if it's something that's going to involve or be of interest to you, then maybe we, on a case by case basis, you get that. You may not want all the sort of wrote things that are happening on a daily basis, but you may want the bigger ticket type opinions and things like that.
We may be asking a question of our attorney or of you, and we don't know if they're responding in a different way or not. How will they know what we're concerned about as well as us knowing what they're concerned
about? So it's going to be very important when we engage legislative council here. We're going to have to come up and talk to the council president about this, but some good protocols because, again, the collaboration goes both ways. You want the collaboration, the cooperation, because you want them to work with those attorneys and get. There may be answers that they've already – there may be some opinions that have already answered some questions. Certainly, legislative council can get it. They may have some other varieties of ways to look at it, and that will come before you. So,
I hope you can help us with that because I don't know at what point that – I don't want something coming to us one way or the other at the end. And they ask all these questions, and they're contrary to some things that we've considered.
There's going to have to be collaboration and cooperation.
Well, I'm hearing two parking lot items, the first of which was the one that Council Member Jackson brought forward with respect to the timeliness of adjacent council, let's call it. And then the second one, with respect to some clarity as to the procurement and when in the process a procurement process can be stopped or deferred or however. So those two I'd like to see addressed at the subsequent meeting. Council Member Priestley Jackson, the floor is yours. And we'll try and keep this brief because we're over the time.
We're going to need a parking lot garage for this.
Yeah, probably so.
Through the chair, thank you so much. And I just want to say, General Counsel Gabriel, I believe sincerely you are sharing with us your legal opinion based on understanding. I'll tell you the challenge, and I just want to say in the room, the council is in the unique position for the first time, I think, in history of having four attorneys on the body politic. What a fun, right? But, and so, four of us. But I think the challenge for me on the 2104, the authorization for JEA doing this, that section is called powers. And the first one, subsection A says, to construct, JEA shall have the following powers in addition to powers otherwise conferred. To construct, own, acquire, establish, improve, extend, enlarge, reconstruct, re-equip, maintain, repair, finance, manage, operate, and promote the utility system. It doesn't say sell. And so I think that my running joke has been, I don't think the framers, Judge Arnold, contemplated an independent authority selling themselves right out of the charter. I don't think they contemplated it. That's been a little running joke of mine. But I think that that's the challenge. So that's the first, that's subsection A. And then when we get on to subsection P, which you've referenced, it then talks about transfer, sale, finance, lease, otherwise provide services or products or byproducts developed or used by JEA. There's a contemplation in these powers of parts or items that they're going to receive or they need services provided, not the very entity itself. I think that that is the rub for us. And when further down, I know you reference if they're going to sell more than 10%. Well, yeah, that still will connote 90% of majority is still held hold and harmless, so it's less than that. I think that that's our confusion. And I know it's my confusion. And I know we've been referencing procurement. Procurement means acquiring. It means acquiring, not selling, in my understanding of it. And so I think that that's why we are challenged with a procurement process that authorized the JEA board to advance an ITN to sell, recapitalize, sell itself. But because that's not the understanding of procurement. They're not, are they going to acquire another entity to buy them? That's the stretch of the term acquiring. And so I don't want to put you on the spot today, but I think we have to look at what are the powers that 2104 is actually saying JEA has. I too find trouble finding any authorization to commence for the recapitalization that results in the sale of the entity under a power. That's the rub. So if we could future.
I think the question in there is the viability of this having the right and opportunity to sell themselves.
Can I give a hypothetical?
Please.
David and Goliath.
The hypothetical is, and just for purposes of this hypothetical, imagine that water is 10% of the operations of JEA, just for purposes of this exercise. If it is 10%, could JEA sell it under that provision? I ask that you can ponder that, and we can talk about it another day. And if they could, well, then certainly they could undertake a process to do so, whether they want to undertake a procurement process or a direct solicitation or some other way of going about it. I'd submit that at a minimum it would allow you to do that. And so how does one even figure out what 10% is of their assets? There's got to be a calculus. Who's in charge of doing the calculus? JEA. And so there's got to be some preliminary process that's undertaken at some point. And if JEA is charged with running the utility, they are certainly the first in line to be able to make that calculus, and hence the reason why they could make the calculus and then decide, you know what, let's give this a shot, and then we'll take it to council and see what council does with it. Anyway, with that being said, I can certainly...
And I appreciate, and we can have further conversations, because I think I differ with the legal understanding of procurement and the ability to do that. But I like the example you just gave of the 10%, because I think one of our issues is, what's the actual valuation of the asset? We don't really know. before you get to the provision that says nothing in this article shall authorize or be construed to authorize JAE to transfer any function or operation. Before the interestingly enough, it says, provided, however, that JAE will not enter into any activity pursuant to this section in addition to those activities listed herein without first providing written notice of such activities to the council auditor no less than 30 days before the commencement of the activity, which would envision for me, before you could determine 10%, the auditors must say what the 10% is. And so I don't know if that happened, but so I think that there were fail-safes put in this. I think that there's a question on interpretation. Before you say 10%, so it seems that the council auditors are supposed to tell us what's the value, what's 10%, and then there would likely be, from that point, that language saying this is the 10% or less that we want to sell or the more. That's all. I'm glad.
Thank you, Ms. Councilmember Jackson. I appreciate that very much. Let me offer a couple perspectives, if I may, before we move on. Number one, obviously, and I understand and appreciate the optics that we're focusing on, the possible recapitalization of JEA. Keep in mind there are five scenarios on the table, which change, it might change the structure of the organization. And quite honestly, I do appreciate the fact what JEA is doing. It's exploring all five. They truly are exploring all five in this process. So I appreciate the fact that we are very focused on one of the scenarios and probably the most likely scenario as presented to us down the road. Let's not lose sight of the opportunity to explore all five of those as we go through this process. Number two, I think a lot of the questions and issues, concerns that are raised today will be addressed both again by Jason or his office down the road. And secondly, obviously, from the perspective of the folks at the board management of JEA. So we have clearly demarcated today what our concerns are, and I do appreciate that in the context of this process. I do want to provide ourselves the opportunity to hear from Ms. Miller. First of all, I want to thank Judge for your time and resources today and Mr. Gabriel for your input in this process. Again, all the contents that materials that we are working from, including the entire Article 21, is available online and some of the other items, too. We will make sure it's all there for you all to see and make decisions of your own accord in this process. So I'm going to quickly invite Ms. Miller to come up and share very quickly, if she can, with us the...
While she's on the way up, I just wanted to say, because every time I come over here, I say this, I want to thank each and every one of you for building our wonderful courthouse. Some of you weren't here when it was built, but you continue to support it and spend a lot of money over there maintaining it, and it is absolutely the finest courthouse in the country, and you should be very proud of what you did for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. $150 million.
Well, I did.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate you both for your time. Ms. Miller. And I appreciate the patience and indulgence of my colleagues in this process. We're trying to keep this as concise as possible. And for the opportunities for us to have further conversations about any of these items, we can move them forward. The process is very fungible, all right? We just set a course. It's a wireframe, as I mentioned before. It can change as we move forward through this process. Ms. Miller, if you quickly, yesterday you sent out from the Civic Council and for the three items, for the benefit of those listening who may not be as familiar with the Civic Council, some of us are, could you quickly give us a thumbnail what the Civic Council is, and then specifically to the letter that you that was forwarded from the subcommittee?
Yes. First of all, thank you for the invitation, and through the Council President, to all of you, thank you also for taking on this process. The Civic Council is a group of 80-plus CEOs in the new Northeast Florida region, organized around essentially mobilizing the collective voice of the CEO to study and analyze difficult public policy issues in our region and hopefully move those forward. So it is a 501c6. It's a membership organization. All members pay dues. We do not accept any public funding. We fund all of our own research, and the idea is to fund research, develop facts, and then from those facts, as we study issues, then to proceed with presenting those facts and information to the public, to the policymakers primarily, and then hopefully draw conclusions and work toward positive public policy change. So with that in mind, in 2017, the Civic Council came out with a strategic plan. There were two strategic objectives, I think one of which you're familiar with, and as I've been before you before, regarding education reform. We've conducted several studies regarding education reform nationally with other groups. And then the second was analyzing the state of the city's public finance structure. We are in the process of conducting a study that, for the very first time, actually looks at the comparative tax base of Duval County and the city of Jacksonville and compares it to other cities and counties throughout the state of Florida. And that work has never been done, and it's a work in progress, I will say. We have had it peer-reviewed. We are working with professors at JU and UNF. Now, in the course of that research, and it has gone on for some time, we recognize that JEA is a very key funding source for the city of Jacksonville. And so when you look at the amount of funds coming from JEA, not just from franchise fees and utility tax, but from a direct contribution. And at the time we started the study, JEA's contribution was close to 20% of the close to $1 billion budget. Now it's obviously a smaller percentage, but still quite a significant contribution. And it's one of only two in the state of Florida that actually makes a contribution to the city. The other is the Orlando Utility Commission. So with that said, the executive committee, when there was discussion about the potential sale or change of JEA, the executive committee convened a subcommittee of our public finance task force to study JEA. That was in January of 2018. This has been a very long road. Using the relationships and reaching out across the nation to investment bankers, to utility experts, to I can't even tell you how many different financial experts, lawyers, a lot of like rating agency individuals, a lot of people in the finance and energy sector. I will tell you this is a highly, highly complex issue. It is extraordinarily complex. It's like an onion. You peel it, you keep peeling it back. So as we commenced, we set out an analytic framework for ourselves to say, here's what we are going to study. And it was going to be, how do you optimize this asset for the city of Jacksonville? That was our question to ourselves and to the public. We shared that with the former special committee on JEA of this council. As we went down that road, we collected a lot of information, but part of our analysis was going to be developing a particular value of JEA, looking at various factors. During the time of our analysis and as we began collecting information, there was a sea change at JEA, both in leadership and in strategic direction. That change resulted in a completely different set of financial projections than were originally, and it was in the form of, you know, the McKinsey study. And that process took quite a long time. And we initially worked very closely with JEA with our external consultants, and received a high level of cooperation in working to get financials by line of business, and it just a lot of information. So suffice it to say, it has been a long road. It's been 18 months. I do know it's a highly complicated process. And as the Civic Council continued on in its work, we came to several conclusions. And one was, because this is a complicated process, the only true way to get your arms around the value of JEA is to conduct a full review of JEA. And a full review, like an appraisal, would take a team of folks, and this is what's done in other communities. It would take a team of people, finance, investment bankers, utility experts, if it's water, if it's sewer, different people, and lawyers. So, and that takes a whole team of people. It usually costs quite a lot of money. It's not unlike what JEA is going through now, right, in some ways. But it would be by the city. And so we knew, as an organization funded through member dues, we did not have the resources for that. We actually priced it out through several different investment firms, who one of which is actually working on the workout for the LA power company publicly. And it was upwards of $500,000 to $1 million to conduct that type of study. So we knew we were unable to do that, but we wanted to stay involved and abreast of what was going on. We were approached in the spring by JEA and asked us to endorse their status quo numbers. And our task force and subcommittee said, we'll be happy to look at this. We need to look under the hood. We need to understand your financial assumptions. We'll be happy to look at it. So we had a scheduled meeting in June. And the plan for that meeting was to, as somebody said, put the green eye shade crowd together to look at the numbers. Unfortunately, that meeting did not turn out that way for a variety of reasons, and we were never able to obtain the underlying financial assumptions and the documents to look at that. We have folks, we have both members and others and engaged financial experts who were retained for that purpose. And then, as you know, in July, the JEA issued an ITN, which appeared to be deviate and was frankly a surprise, I think, for everyone. And so our executive committee said, given the change of direction and given the fact that this appears to be moving so quickly already, let's regroup and retain experts to look at the process. Look at this process. What would any municipality want to go through? What would any municipality do in a process like this if there were a disposition or sale or even just an evaluation of your assets? And our experts, I've sent you an original report from Jerry Hartman, who's a double board certified engineer, as well as an opinion from the Gray Robinson Law Firm. Mr. Jason Burnett is here from the Gray Robinson Law Firm. But we asked the question, you know, what would any municipality want to know if there was a process to dispose of an asset? You know, what would you want to know? What would the public want to know? And what do you have to go through? What are those requirements? And so that was the task ahead. And fortunately, Mr. Hartman has been a part of over 635 different transactions to sell or transfer or restructure a utility. So he's very familiar in 36 states around the United States. And then Mr. Cloud of the Gray Robinson Law Firm has been practicing in this area for over 40 years, primarily in the state of Florida, and has worked with, since the 70s on primarily municipal disposition. So we examined that process. What you have, and there's no time today to go through that, but I would strongly encourage you to call upon Mr. Hartman and Mr. Cloud for that. But out of that came several things. We also have looked at the financials and engaged experts to look at the financials, talked with the Florida Municipal Power Association, and talked with private sector, like the bond rating agencies and analysts who previously worked for bond rating agencies. So across the board, we were told, JEA is not in a financial crisis. Is it hitting some headwinds? Yes. Does it need to potentially restructure? Possibly. And so how do you combat that? How does a public utility, what are the options available to a public utility or municipality if you have concerns? So looking at that, we believed, and based on the research, based on our research, based on the opinions of these individuals, we're recommending that this council, and based on a reading, as Mr. Gabriel said, all roads lead to city council. Now, Mr. Cloud knows Tom Welch, also a former general counsel, who he's consulted with in rendering his opinion, who said that JEA can absolutely go through the exercise it is going through. It is exploring one of what it has laid out for itself, five options, right? There are five options that the McKinsey report. Right. So it can go through this process. But it is one part of a larger process. And really the duty, the ownership under Florida law of the municipality is the city. And you are the elected officials of the owners of that, right? The owners of the utility have elected you to office. And this city essentially gave JEA the franchise to operate. And so if you think of it that way, as well as to operate water and sewer. When you think about it, it's a bit of a nuanced, it's nuanced. So JEA can continue its work, but its work is not the only consideration. This council should take control of the entire process. There is a duty under Florida law for whoever has to approve the sale. You have to undergo very specific requirements, public hearings, analyses, making a business case, and those are outlined in the letter that we sent to you. So while JEA can conduct this and certainly present you with an option, you are not limited to that option. And one would say that your duty is to explore all options and to make sure that you have before you all of the information. So I, again, applaud you for convening this. I will close with this, that when we look at this and come down to it, it appears that the primary motivation in all of this is funds for the city. And if that is correct, and if the city needs $3 billion, then the primary question here is, what is the, how much money does the city need? What do we need it for? And you know, then lay out a plan to get that, because it's a very healthy exercise to analyze your assets. You should always understand how much you own and your value. Very healthy. And our experts will tell you, you should at least go through this process every 10 to 20 years, understand your value. But it's not your only asset. There are other ways and other triggers if the city needs money. And that process should be a very public process. And this community has had a very long and successful history under Mayor Hazzuri, under all of our mayors, the recent mayors under Ed Austin and John Delaney, and even Mayor Curry, in responding to a need. Our citizenry understands the need for pension reform. They understood that after years and years of complexities, and they responded and they voted. So we would encourage you to take a step back and examine what are the needs of the city. If we need to sell an asset or consider other assets, then what are the right mechanisms for that?
Well, I appreciate your comments. I certainly, Mr. Wilson, I don't want to chair that committee. So. Mr. Diamond.
Thank you, Gene, for being here. It's a great deal of respect for you, and it's, I love that you're getting all sorts of new friends in the last 24 hours. That's good stuff. I guess I'm a kind of a bottom line guy, mm-hmm. and I understand what you're saying about process and procedure and the city council. I have to assume that there's probably some number. Let's say somebody offered us $100 billion for JEA. I would assume that the Civic Council will say, yeah, every day, we sell it right now, immediately, here you go. And that at $500 million, the answer is no way, not a chance, it doesn't make any sense at all. Does the Civic Council have a number where they feel that this would make sense for us? And if so, what is it?
Yeah. So through the chair to Councilmember Diamond, the Civic Council has not considered, and we have not studied. So we have not studied that, and the letter is clear that we are not opining on whether a sale should take place. And on what terms? We are not opining at this time. At this time, the concern is regarding the process and the concern that it is it lacks fundamental transparency. And as we know now from Florida law, there are certain requirements for that. So if this council wants to do this, then the process is salvageable. It's salvageable. I mean, you know, Mr. Cloud and Mr. Hartman will tell you, if you want to save the process, you can do that. But there are certain things you need to go back and cover. So we don't have an answer to that. That if that question comes up, then the council will apply its resources and analyze it to the best of its ability.
But to the extent that the conversation you and I had yesterday, the process we are undertaking right now is certainly in line with the expectations and the, as part of that process, correct?
It would seem to me, without you know knowing more and looking sure. at your the titles, but I would encourage you to, again, Mr. Cloud's available and, sure. and others and. Yes.
Mr. Bowman.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Ms. Miller. Civic Council has been an amazing resource for me, and I appreciate what you all have done. A question for you, and maybe we don't have to answer today, but with the expertise you have, my family's in a position where we're selling a piece of property right now. Mm-hmm. There's two ways we can do it. We can go get it appraised, mm-hmm. or we can go see what the offers are and give us an idea of that market value, and it sounds like you all are looking at doing the appraisal part. And so my question is that given that we've got, I think, 15 people that are groups that are offering something on that, at the end of the day, will that give us a good idea of what JEA is really valued, or would we need to is there still value in going out and getting an appraisal done on it, even though we've got 15, we know what the market's willing to yes. purchase it for.
And thank you, through the chair, to Council Member Bowman. This question came up yesterday. We had a special member meeting to discuss that, and Mr. Hartman is best to answer this question for you. But let me clarify, we are not conducting an appraisal. An appraisal would require the expertise of cross disciplines, and that would be the duty of the city. So let me be clear about that. And that was the cost quite a bit of money. But Mr. Hartman examined and said, look, an appraisal is the typical part of what you would do to understand the value. The ITN as structured and is wide open. It does not address the value of real estate. It does not address lots of different types of values. So, and there are different values that are important in this process. There's the PSC, the Public Service Commission, in determining what's called rate base. They're going to look at a value. And then you can have your appraised value. So to extend your analogy of selling your property, I'm assuming you have some sense of what the market will bear and you go out to offer. Let's say I want to buy your property, and I come to you and say I'd like to buy your property, and other people have, and you have some competitive bids. But I have to finance your property. So I go to a bank. A bank is going to require an appraisal. Or I might, if I'm buying it for cash, want to know an appraisal. You go through a due diligence period. If you're buying something, you would do a phase one. I'd like to know the environmental. I'd do an inspection. I'd want to know what I was buying and be fully informed as a purchaser. So if you kind of think about it that way, then that would be the role. If you are a seller or a buyer, you want to know. Mr. Hartman would tell you he has been in several situations where, and most recently in the city of Vero Beach, where the city was where a one of the bidders offered, I think, $100 million. I'll use round numbers because I don't recall. It's a very small. So let's say it was $50 million. He came in with an appraisal that he did with a team, and this is not to promote his services with that regard. This is more to say with the team analyzed some of the additional assets that the property had, that the utility had, that weren't taken into consideration in the bids. So although the original bids were $50 million, it eventually sold for $100 million. So you want to have a thorough understanding of what it is you're selling and the value of that. And that's would be, I would suggest, a duty as public servants and as far as your sure. fiduciary duty. But, I hope that answers your question.
It does.
Yes.
Mr. Salem and Ms. McCumber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Ms. Miller, I was confused by a comment you made about at one point you were requesting financials on the JEA and they were not responsive to that. And then at some point, it sounds like you got that financial information in order to do this analysis. Can you clarify that for me?
Sure, yes. Can
you explain more what you requested? Mm-hmm. Emails, who you sent them to. Yeah. I'm very curious about that.
So in the initial stages, we wanted to get a consolidated and a consolidating bank balance sheet for all lines of business. That did not exist. So JEA went to the effort of actually putting that together. It took many, many hours, but they actually said they found it useful. You may be familiar with Howard Circuit and Heritage Capital, who donated his pro bono time to assist us in developing what we wanted to get was some type of estimated value and a discounted cash flow analysis for the various lines, but also together. So that was in the spring of 2018. As you know, everything changed during that time. So leadership changed, and then the interim leadership told us, we can do all of this for you, but because there were some additional information that we asked for, but it is not good. These are not good projections. We are going to reevaluate these projections. We are engaging a consultant. So we stopped. I mean, there's not much more you can do when they say, because they say we're about to reforecast with the assistance of a nationally recognized consulting agency. So we stopped on that. Then McKinsey came out with its own status quo projection. So when we asked for the data and the underlying assumptions, we asked to speak to McKinsey, we asked repeatedly, and we were asked to actually endorse that in May. And our membership said, we don't do anything without doing research, so we want to look under the hood. So let's look under the hood. So a meeting that was supposed to be out three or four people to look under the hood, talk to McKinsey, get the underlying data, trying to understand that so we could come forward with some opinion. We were not provided with that. And then Mr. Hartman, in doing his analysis, asked Mr. Zahn and his team for specific documents. We had an hour-long interview with them, very graciously provided, and there were specific requests. And then they promised to provide some certain information, and there were follow-up requests that were unanswered. I will give you a very specific example. We asked for the McKinsey RFP. We asked for the McKinsey proposal to say, what have they proposed? What's the scope of services, and what's the cost of that? we were sent back a very heavily redacted document. Under Florida law, when you redact something, you have to state the reason why. It was not. So I asked, I sent an email back and said, what is the basis for the redaction? And we received a letter from McKinsey, not from JEA, claiming trade secret. Now, this is a deal that's already closed, that's already moving forward on purchase, and so it was hard, but we didn't press the issue anymore. But to suffice it to say, I don't know what McKinsey was asked to do, and I don't know how much they paid for it. So that was difficult because we wanted to understand. We didn't want to duplicate McKinsey's process. We wanted to be additive to it. So that was the purpose of asking for the RFP.
Thank you. Okay. I need to tidy it up. I have three or four more questions here. Can I just very quick?
Did you follow up with any city council members that could have facilitated that? No. You strictly went civic council to JEA.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Councilmember McCumber.
Thank you, and thanks for being here. So was the letter and everything you're voicing, is that a unanimous feeling of the civic council, or are there civic council members who have a different view or take a different tact on this?
So the answer to that is the executive committee of the civic council is the policy-making body, and the executive committee is made is 10 to 12 people, along with the and then the task force chairs are ex officio members. As for the executive committee, it is unanimous. The members were given an opportunity to review, to provide input, to receive feedback. And some of the members, as even with education, some members do not agree. But when members agree to participate in the Civic Council and pay dues, they agree and they understand that the organization has its own values. And the values and intends to advocate. So I can't speak for another member. But I we did not take an organization-wide vote because the process is through the executive committee.
Okay, thank you. And then you said that the process is salvageable. Can you kind of go through the specifics of what you think council hasn't done to this point? And I know you mentioned public hearings, and we have 15 or so public hearings set up in addition to our regular council process. So. You seem to imply that there are things that we should have done to date that we haven't done or that we haven't set up. So if you could kind of list those out so we're clear on what you
think. I can direct you to the PowerPoint presentation by Mr. Hartman, and he presented for almost an hour yesterday, so that would take a lot of time, and out of respect for your time and everyone else's, I would encourage you to, sure. We can help, arrange for Mr. Hartman to be here to present that to you on what would typically happen in a municipality if you were undertaking this. So I don't have that list off the top of my head, but Mr. Hartman has that as well as Mr. Clark.
And it's laid out in the PowerPoint that you provided us yesterday, correct?
There is some. And so there is, and then you'll also see a flow chart. So there's a lot of details packed into that, and you see the larger if you see the larger report from May 2018.
It's a brief answer because they've got
super quick follow-up. So on that, so there's nothing specifically that the Civic Council, the executive body of the Civic Council, thinks that council isn't doing right now. It's more the consultant that is looking at these sort of situations at large.
No, the executive committee has approved the letter that you received yesterday, and there are seven recommendations there. There are seven observations. So I would say I think those are fairly direct, and if you question any of those. So, yes, they have, based on our research and the observations from that research.
Councilmember Becton.
Thanks, through the chair. To Ms. Miller, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I just got really one question, but it's based on my observation, having been through a lot of these meetings and so forth, is that this whole process is we're here because at the heart of the JEA reasoning for going through this process is not because we need cash.
Right.
That has never kind of been on the table. But it's been for two things. That the future forecast as it relates to its revenue projections, and number two, the constraints on any future solutions that addresses those revenue projections. So you mentioned that the Civic Council started exploring at least the first point there.
Right.
Have y'all given up on that initiative, whether it's doing it in parallel or, as Mr. Salem mentioned,
yes,
through open record sunshine laws,
yeah,
provide us the data? Because from what I understand, it is there, and that is hopefully part of what we're going to set our sites to do.
Right.
Are you guys going to keep up that initiative?
No. Not at this time, and here is the problem. At this time, we asked for all of the underlying information. So when the new projections came out in May, we immediately asked for the underlying financial assumptions and to speak directly with McKinsey, so we understood what went into that. We'd have to unpack a lot of information. We were not provided with that opportunity, but as part of that conclusion. Whether it's going through scenario 1, 2, 3, 4, that is the duty, or scenario 6, 7, or 8. Whatever those scenarios look like for this city, it's the duty of this group to consider that, as well as the needs of the city. And I would submit, so it is, I can't sit here today and tell you that the financial projections are correct. I can't tell you what the bait, because I don't know, everything's based on an assumption. And we don't have that. That has been part of this. So that was the reason why the executive committee decided to weigh in on the process at this time. And to the extent we can be additive to your process and your analysis based on what we have collected to date, we'll be happy to do that. But beyond the process right now, there's not been a decision on what the next step will be.
I believe there were two more questions, and we're going to limit it to that. Mr. Hazari first, and then Mr. Carlucci.
That's great. You can answer yes or no. And I think you've kind of answered part of my question on the financials. Have y'all been working on that since y'all started 18 months ago?
Financials?
Yes.
So we started when Mr. McElroy was here and working right with Melissa Dykes, and then that changed. Then we were told that was January, February, March, April, May. Then we were told that the financials, May, June, those would be, they were no good, that they were restructuring the financials. So we should wait. We should not do a continued analysis based on those financial projections because they're wrong. That's what we were told. So we stopped. We did not want to add. So then we received the new financials, and that goes to Mr. Becton's question. But in order to understand financials, you have to get into the assumptions.
Right.
And we have not been provided that.
The only reason I'm saying, because at the very beginning of the conversation, your conversation, was that everybody that y'all talked to would tell you that they're okay.
Yes.
I mean, that's basically what you said.
Right.
Now, that tells me, the headline today, that we're in a spiral. I know y'all didn't write that, but that the JEA is not in a spiral.
Actually, it is in our letter.
That would be your conclusion from talking to whoever you talk to.
Based
on the information available to us.
Right. If you can send us whatever financials that y'all have done or studied.
Well, it was from over a year ago, and we've already been told by JEA that they are.
So nothing new that. Okay.
We've not been provided with that information.
The other thing I want to mention. Mr. Hartman can be reached how?
Well, I've got his contact.
Okay. The other question, you know, again, it goes back to him. When you said that the whole reason, and he didn't say that was the reason of JEA, because they get nothing out of it. It comes to us, and we make a decision, was the assets and what we get out of it. Well, that's part two. That's the elephant in the room. If all this takes place and comes to us and we vote, goes to a referendum, the whole thing, then that's going to be the bigger question among all of us, the council, the mayor, and everybody else. I think what we're looking at is I think the JEA is doing fine studying it. That's fine. I have a position on it. Uh-huh. But if they come forth with something that, you know, that we all think that's good for the city and the taxpayers and the ratepayers, that's fine. But as far as the assets, that's another new animal that we're going to have to deal with a long time from now, if we have to do it at all.
Mr. Carlos, you've got the closing question.
Okay. I got two questions real quick. You just said haven't been provided with that information.
Yes.
Okay. What kind of information?
It's listed in Exhibit A. It's listed in Exhibit A.
Is it public information?
This is what I don't know. So we asked for certain information. So I don't know if it either doesn't exist or if it exists, why it wasn't produced. So that was unclear. We were just told, no, we're not going to answer that, and then go to the next.
They should turn that over.
I agree, right. but our quandary at this point in time is we were just told no, and then move on to the next question in the interview. So I don't know if it's available and whether it exists, so it would be available, or if it doesn't exist, then it doesn't exist.
Okay, that
no
quandary
is an answer.
Right there, I'd like to get an answer from the JEA.
And you will.
As to why it has not been provided. Now, the second thing I wanted to ask is, you got it on second page here, it says, however, the disposition of our city's largest taxpayer-owned asset,
is far too important to be considered in legally flawed closed-door negotiations that contradict current nationwide trends and could potentially result in negative consequences for the community. Are those current nationwide What's the nationwide
through the chair.
Trend you're talking
about? Yes, through the chair to Mr. Carlucci. The most recent Florida example is when the city of Winter Park voted by overwhelming referendum to take back their utility, and I think you've looked in California. There are several examples.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Well, I failed miserably in managing the clock today. I apologize to all concerned.
You did a good job.
We have one blue card. Mr. Forker, do you want to defer till?
Mr. Chairman, I can just speak with you and Mr. Billy after the meeting.
I look forward to that conversation.
Mr. Billy?
Any other comments? I thank you all for your time and your patience, your interest in staying aboard. This is a marathon, so please bear with us, and we will go through this very carefully and cautiously. Thank you all. We are adjourned.
I just want to ask him a question.
Ask you a question. Mike,
how do you want us, if there are follow-up questions, what do you want us to do? Okay.
Are you all right?
Hey, how are you?
Nice to meet you.
Thank you. I really appreciate
it. It is.
Okay.
Thank you.